now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you all for joining us. I'm delighted to say that with me in the studio today, it's James Gearbrandt and James Scowcroft. We'll be breaking down the Premier League weekend, and later on, I know you're excited, we'll be joined by Matthew Syed. He's written a piece in The Game on Dele Alli and all the hoopla surrounding his gesture at Wembley in midweek. But there's one place to start, and that's at the Etihad. And within the Etihad, there seems to be one incident with which to start. So let's go and get this out of the way straight away. And by the way, we can also juxtapose with Alfie Mawson and Matt Ritchie, since that seems to be like the original thing to do in the sense that everybody's done it. Mane on Ederson. Scoey. Correct decision?
No. If it was on the halfway line, I'd say yes. But I'm going to bring this point up for you. Risk and reward. Okay, so you're a centre forward. And the reward is, if you get that first touch, you're going to score a goal. Or you'll get the goalkeeper sent off. So the reward is extremely, extremely high. If it's on the halfway line, you don't get that reward. You probably just win the ball. And I think he has to go for that. Because if you don't, you get all your away fans behind the goal. If it's at home, you would be Barrett. Oh, you know, you should have gone for that. So I think in that situation, in that area of the pitch, it was the wrong decision.
Well, you're doing two different things, though, here. Because I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, maybe he does have to go for it. And as people went on about endlessly, it's not malicious. He's not that sort of player. He was looking at the ball, blah, blah, blah. But there's a difference between saying he has to go for it and he should not get sent off. I mean, sometimes you have to do things. And if you don't get to the ball first, you get sent off as a result.
Yeah, well, that's my point. Why, if you have to do something, you're punishing somebody for something that he has to do. That doesn't make sense, Gab.
But the rules of the game are kind of...
But the rules of the game are a lot stricter than what you've just pointed out. You've pointed out that it wasn't malicious. It doesn't have to be malicious anymore.
No,
it doesn't
have to be. No, I completely agree. I point out, but you're saying, like, because he has to go for it, yeah. Right? It's a bit like if you're in the penalty box and you have to clear the ball by attempting an overhead kick next to somebody's head,
yeah,
you might still get done for dangerous play, right?
But you shouldn't.
But you're talking about the way things should be. When you talk about the way things are, do you agree that based on the laws of the game and that should have been a red? Or that is a red based on the laws of the game and maybe the law is just unfortunate?
The laws of the game is a red, yes, I agree. Okay. But what I'm saying to you, there has to be... You know, there has to be
scope for interpretation
sense,
from the referee.
Yes, exactly. Common sense has to prevail. You know, it has to come in where, you know, just the referee guy, just calm him down, calm the crowd, everyone down, yellow card, say, look, told him what he's done, don't do it. But, you know, you have to understand why he did it.
James?
I mean, I thought it was a red card, and I'd actually go farther. I thought it was a good piece of refereeing by John Moss. I mean, he was in exactly the perfect position. He had a great view of it. I kind of hear what Sko is saying, but of course the problem is that once you start getting into should referees take into account the area of the pitch, you know, the risk and reward, which is...
I have to say, that's not something I'd heard in sort of the gallons of hot air that's been thrown out about this. That's not something... You're the first person, I think, to bring up the risk-reward.
A goalkeeper gets sent off if he brings down the last man because if he happened on the halfway line, I know it's hypothetical because the goal... Do you understand? So that's... I just think you have to... I've been in that situation before as a centre-forward where you're bearing down on the goalkeeper and if you think, I better pull out here because if not, I'm going to get sent off. The manager would go ballistic on the sideline and at half-time, would it? The crowd you're playing in front of would... Pff, get him off. He's not. He doesn't show any desire. He doesn't see. You don't have a choice.
The corollary, though, of saying that referees should take into account the area of the pitch and the kind of the risk reward for the striker in that, the tackler in that situation, is that then you're asking the referee to make quite a subjective call. Scurry might be saying, in that case, it was, you know, Mane might have scored, and on the halfway line it would have been a red. Well, what if it's sort of in a kind of in-between area? But the point I'm trying to make is that once you start asking the referee to make a subjective call like that, that's when you're never going to get consistency. You're making potentially two different decisions based on, you know, the same type of challenge because of a different area of the pitch, or the referee has a different interpretation of what the reward was for the striker in that situation. So you're never going to get this kind of mythical consistency that people want.
No, I would tend to agree with that. I always wonder how aware is Mane, or is a striker in that situation, right? Because viewed from the outside, there's a whole bunch of calculations that we would expect Mane to take into account, which is, you know, the likelihood that he gets there first, at what point he's obviously looking for the ball, not for Ederson, but he clearly must know because he has peripheral vision that Ederson's coming. Does he think that, you know, all right, Ederson's outside his box, so he's either going to run into me, which is good because then I get him sent off, or he might forget where he is and handle the ball, which is good because then, you know, it goes our way. Or is he going to try to do some weird, uncoordinated goalkeeper karate kick, which might be good because it's not going to work? Let me finish. What do you even expect the guy to go and just put his head down into the boot? What I'm saying is, does Mane's mind, and I'm asking this because I don't know how much actually your brain can actually process. If I go in with my boot with my boot like that, aren't I telling Ederson, right, there's absolutely no way this guy's going to put his face, exactly, even if he gets there first? Right?
Exactly. You're spot on. So if you look at the Swansea situation yesterday, Alfie Mott pulls out. If he goes into it, Matt Ritchie gets sent off because he'll catch him. But because at the last minute he's pulled out. Now, Marnie's got an argument to say, well, I didn't realise he's going to put his head in. Did he not?
That's a fair argument, but... You know, we always love to say he's entitled to go for the ball. Well, Ederson, you know, you can't blame Ederson for being brave and putting his head in there, which is really the only thing he could have done. Do you see what I'm saying? And in the same way that in football, sometimes when we say there's fouls when there's no contact, right? When you go something and you force somebody to pull out, which is effectively what he might have been, which is maybe, again, I don't know that Mane thought all these things through, but you could, maybe his brain does go that, maybe it does work that fast. You could also make the point, well, Mane's going in that way because he knows that Ederson's necessarily going to pull out because nobody would be stupid enough to put their head in the way of a flying boot.
I would say it's impossible for him to process all of those thoughts when you've literally got maybe half a second, a quarter of a second.
I would have thought so too. You've been in that situation though. When you play, aren't there a whole bunch of things that, you know, just certain familiarity, muscle memory, whatever, that allows you to process things a lot more quickly than...
But not that quick. I actually broke my collarbone once in a very similar situation where the goalie came up. I think it must have been just on the edge of the box because he caught it with his arms, but his knees came up and his knees came into my body and I broke my collarbone. Now, you know, that's acceptable for a goalkeeper, isn't it? But that again is that kind of decision.
How fast were you going?
Very fast.
Right.
What's your take on it? Red or yellow? Or none?
I'm going to wuss out here and say I have a ton of sympathy for Mane, but it's red. It's a red because it ends up being dangerous. Ederson, you know, you can't... The fact that Ederson did something that I think most goalkeepers, most players would never dream of doing and do something dangerous, but that dangerous to himself, to his own health, that doesn't mitigate it. Like I said, I mean, you know, I think most keepers would not have reacted that way. I think most sane people wouldn't have reacted that way. I mean, you know, it's... And that's his reward.
I mean, one thing that... kind of comparison that I thought was quite interesting is that, I mean, clearly they're very different situations, but if you remember the infamous Nigel de Jong studding Xabi Alonso in the chest, I don't think I've ever heard anyone argue that Nigel de Jong shouldn't have been sent off that. I mean, it's kind of gone down as a sort of infamously sort of even comically bad decision on the part of Howard Webb. But in this case, I mean, I just think it's interesting that in this case, Mane's boot was higher. It was probably more dangerous, and yet you've actually got this quite sort of even debate. I mean, is that because of this kind of this perception that Mane kind of had to go for it?
Is there intent? Do you think he's really? I don't think there's
was no there intent on De Jong's part. I mean, do you think De Jong said, "Oh, I'm going to go and karate kick Xabi Alonso in the chest"? Probably not, right? I mean,
I'll go back to my original point: risk and reward. And I think the reward is very, very high. So you have to have an element of risk.
There's a narrative. It was 1-0 at the time. There's a narrative by which, if Mane doesn't get sent off, then this game goes in a wholly different direction, and Liverpool equalize, and everything's fine. And you know, certainly City aren't 5 goals better. Anybody see the start of that game that way, as sort of like Liverpool and City being close?
Liverpool did have chances, didn't they? But they were goal down. Very rarely does it doesn't help. It doesn't help you going forward. But defensively, very rarely does going down to 10 men affect you defensively.
If you're a normal team, if you're Liverpool.
Well.
No, I mean, Klopp, I thought, sees things differently, right? When you go down to 10 men, right, everybody goes to the 4-4-1 and they all kind of stand around. It didn't happen here.
No, but Klopp has a philosophy on pressing the ball, doesn't he? You can't press the ball with 10 men, especially against a team like Man City.
And yet he kind of went for it. And what struck me about, I think, 3 of those goals were were basically through balls. Mm. I'm like, how does that happen when you're... I mean, we can blame the defenders, blame the midfielders, but... If you give up so many chances on through balls,
it's game management. So game management. You're as a player, you're taught at 10 men. So you stay in the game.
You're saying what you were taught, and you're describing conventional wisdom.
I think it's general,
but it's general, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what Liverpool did, is it?
No, but why? This is what we. This is Jurgen Klopp. It's Liverpool's Achilles heel, isn't it?
But were you thinking, was it bad instructions from Klopp, or is it just bad execution from the players?
The scoreline says it was bad.
But you think it's... Were those Klopp's instructions...
So you're 1-0 down, and you go down to 10 men. Okay, so the first step in that game, can you get to half-time 1-0 down? Calm everyone down.
No, I understand this. I think most people do. But what I'm saying is, were those Klopp's instructions...
No.
Okay, so Klopp said we're not gonna use the conventional wisdom.
He just carries on as normal.
We're gonna carry on as normal. In some ways, the blame in inverted commas falls on Klopp more so than on his players.
All day long.
Now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. Please sign up. It's £8 for an 8-week trial. I think it's tremendous value for money myself. Now we have our goal of the weekend in the Premier League. James, I'm going to start with you. I think I know what you're going to say.
I've picked Eric-Maxim Choupo-Moting's first goal for Stoke. I just thought it was a really... nicely worked team goal. Great pass by Fletcher out to Mame Biram Diouf at wing back, who timed his run perfectly, just on the shoulder of Darmian, chested the ball down nicely and sort of bent his cross round Darmian, and it was really well finished by Choupo-Moting, who sort of got the better of Baye, I think it was, in the centre.
Does Phil Jones getting lost just add to the beauty of the goal?
I wasn't even aware of Phil Jones. He didn't sort of figure in my kind of mind's eye picture of the goal.
Scully, I'm assuming you probably scored a few more goals than Gerbrandt did in his professional football career. So what's your choice?
I'm actually going to go for a very basic goal, but very good. Harry Kane's second goal at Goodison Park. Fantastic centre-forward play. Came off the ball, received the ball to feet very well. Plays it out wide. And like any good centre-forward, gets into the box and a very good finish as well.
Kane's movement was exceptional, I think.
Very good.
It's one of his best attributes. The only thing I would say, if you were coaching, if you were Ronald Koeman, would you take your centre-backs behind the woodshed? Or would you just say, oh, bravo, look, Kane's movement was so good. There's nothing you guys could have done. It's Harry Kane. There's two of you. You can't It just seemed like he made himself invisible and then just kind of reappeared in between the two of them.
It's shocking defending, isn't it? But
okay.
But we're talking about goals, not defending.
No. just wanted to establish that. Oh, well done, Harry Kane, by the way. August, of course, is over. Did I say we're joined now by Matthew Syed, who had, as usual, a Monday column in the game. And Matthew, you in this one, you wrote about Dele Alli and obviously his gesture in the England game when he gave somebody the finger. FIFA will go and establish whether it was a match official or a teammate. But what I'm interested in is that you take the line that, if I interpret this correctly, the abuse that Alli took from a lot of observers was over the top and perhaps linked to his working class background?
Yes. So thanks. Morning, Gab. Morning, James and James. Yes, I felt that what Dele Alli did was wrong and that an investigation is probably a valid thing to do to establish whether he was gesturing at the referee or, as I understand, he claims that one of his teammates. So he can't have people going around on the football pitch making obscene gestures, and I can understand why there might be some kind of proportionate sanction. But my sort of deeper sense is looking, you know, I have to say, a relatively cursory glance at Twitter and some of the sanctimonious moralizing that I saw in some of the coverage of the incident. He was sort of described as a bit of a chav, you know, somebody who didn't deserve to wear the shirt. And I think there is a bit of anti-working class sentiment that is directed at footballers, where we tarnish them with the same brush, that they're all basically thuggish and brutish. And I think that that is also underpinning the way that we often malign footballers for having the audacity with their bloody working class accents to earn a lot of money, despite the fact that they do so in a completely free and fair meritocratic environment. And I think I did read a bit of that into this particular incident, but I think it's a much more pervasive phenomenon and a very British one. We're very acutely class conscious in Britain. And I think footballers, by and large, as a group, get a very bad press.
It's an interesting one because, I mean, for me personally, I agree that it happened. I mean, I just look at what Wayne Rooney got, especially when he was younger, but it, perhaps even today, you know, saying he's going to end up like Gaza and stuff. I thought that was also, there's a kind of dog whistle statements, I guess is how I'd put it. What I find interesting here is that, at least to me, my perception of Dele Alli, I didn't necessarily view him like that, nor did I realize. I mean, he's somebody who I think came across as somebody who's had a temper in the past, some stupid red cards, indiscipline. This to me is, you know, regardless who he was giving the finger to, this is another example of indiscipline. But people go on about the working class game and so on. Is there a sense that you can be working class in football and there's no stigma to it? If you're sort of the yeoman, hardworking, thank you, sir, may I have another, working class sort of guy who goes in the trenches and fights for the empire and so on and keeps a stiff upper lip and all this stuff. But if somehow you don't fit that image, there's more of an issue. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think all of what you said I agreed with amazingly. I do think that that's right, that if there is that salt of the earth approach, a sort of subservient working class demeanor, I think that's much more socially acceptable to the middle and upper classes, if I can use that sort of ancient Marxist terminology. You mentioned Rooney. It's an extraordinary and depressing thing that you only have to mention his name on some of the Radio 4 comedy shows for the entire audience to start laughing at his inadequate answers in press conferences, that he's slightly monosyllabic, that he isn't as polished as what he would be if he had gone to a private school and been given debating training and all of the other advantages that they have. I went back and looked at some of Rooney's early exam results, by the way. He was absolutely stellar at mathematics at primary school, and he was very, very good in most of his subjects. But of course, most footballers who make the grade have to make a choice early on about whether they focus on this. I think it's a shame that it's an invidious choice to make, and it'd be great if the academies gave better access to education and that young players took them up on it. But often they had to make a choice, and Rooney didn't get the education because he was trying to forge a career in football. And to joke and laugh and mock and vilify him because he isn't as articulate as other people who have had the opportunities that he didn't access, I think is unfair and again, symptomatic of the prejudice, you know, we're discussing.
Matthew, thank you so much. Matthew's column is in the Game on Monday, and Matthew, I had to cut it a little bit short because apparently our pal Frank DeBoer has been sacked by your pal, and this I say, James Scowcroft, Steve Parrish. Scowie wrote down DeBoer sacked on a piece of paper. This isn't some kind of joke. He's actually been sacked?
4 games, I believe he's the quickest, the shortest managerial record in Premier League history.
Beating Les Reed's record.
By a whole 3 games as well.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so, and it looks like our old favourite Roy Hodgson is going to come and replace him.
If you're really paying Doogie Friedman, why don't you just have him do it?
Well, that could be a case as well. So watch this space.
But just to be clear, Roy Hodgson not confirmed.
Not confirmed, but Frank DeBoer leaving has been confirmed. And where'd you go with that one?
All right, first of all, I go back to this. I hate doing it because I know he's your friend. And then, you know, Julian's not here to say mean things. But what is it with Steve Parrish's judgment on people? And I go back to this. Warnock, Moody, Pulis, you know, the ability to read people, know how they fit in an environment. You go from Allardyce to this guy. And I don't blame him because DeBoer had a nightmare at Inter. Basket Case Club, he was a very late appointment. He certainly screwed up a lot of things, but it was a very difficult situation in which to work. So I don't blame him for that. I think he's a good manager. He may have a right future in the right context, but surely his team was not built for Frank DeBoer type football at all. Why?
Because it hasn't been a Palace way, has it? Palace traditionally have been in your face, counter-attacking football, big centre forward, get the ball forward early, difficult to play against, and the swinging from one side. I think Alan Pardew failed by trying to, you know, go down that road, failed. Sam Allardyce comes in, totally changes it, hard to beat, they succeed. And it's another massive swing to Frank DeBoer. For me, I could see it coming. I thought it was on borrowed time from day one. I just couldn't see how it was going to work.
I don't have a problem with them saying, like, you know, we played this way, now we want to change and become, you know, a different type of side. But if you do that, then you have to take the necessary steps in the transfer window. And the reality is you spent an enormous amount of money on Christian Benteke. He's locked into a long-term contract. He's not going anywhere.
Yeah, completely. And as you say, they didn't get him a lot of pieces in the transfer window. I also think, and I watch Crystal Palace a lot last season, I think there's a chronic overestimation of the actual quality in their squad. Last season, you sort of heard incessantly, you know, you've got too much quality to go down. I think there are a lot of players in that squad living on their reputations, like Johan Kabay. Benteke, you know, I think he's a very erratic player.
Scully, Doogie Friedman wasn't there. He was appointed in late August as the sporting director. They have this guy named Ko, I think, not Seb, but some other dude who's their head of recruitment.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Tim Ko.
And then there's Parrish and Mark Bright.
Yeah.
Who, I don't know if Mark Bright has an official role or not. What's your understanding? Did they sit together at the end of last season and said, like, all right, Sam's leaving, who can we get? Oh, we like the way this guy plays football and let's go in a different direction? Or,
well, I think there's two schools of thought, isn't it? I don't think anyone saw Sam leaving the way he did. I think that was unexpected. But they did have time over the summer. There was a lack of managers around this. You know, there's not a glut of managers, is there, that you can choose from?
That is such a lame excuse.
I'm not saying it is an excuse at all.
Oh, there aren't many managers
Hear me
around.
Out. Hear me out. What Premier League owners should do, they should be looking into the Championship and lower it. Why they don't, I do not know.
There's some dude, now I don't even remember what club he's at, who's heralded as some kind of genius. He's like in his late 40s. He was at Northampton.
Chris Wilder.
Yes. Come on, Football League man. Should they have signed Chris Wilder? What makes Chris Wilder good? Who is Chris Wilder, for those of us who don't know?
Well, Chris Wilder is the current Sheffield United manager, isn't he? That's doing a very good job with Sheffield United. There's other managers that...
And he's got proper English players, right? Is it Sheffield United have all the English players, or is it Wednesday?
Sheffield United do.
There you go,
Sheffield United
proper.
Are a very big football club. You should really... Have you ever been to Bramall Lane?
I have. I am very familiar with the Blaines. I know Neil Warnock. I've been there when they were in the Premier League. We've been through this. I don't follow the Football League. Because I'm a snob, it's just because I have other stuff to do. Steve Parrish, his tweets last night. Now... Again, I remember saying he's a criticism of the guy. I think he was maybe emotional when he tweeted them. I think when an owner of a football club makes a statement in that situation, it has to be very clear what he's saying. Either very clearly hint that you're going to sack him or very clearly give your support. I read all his tweets. I couldn't tell if he's planning to sack him or if he's willing to stick with him. I just all this ambiguity.
Right. To be fair to Steve Parrish, if you look at Crystal Palace's next four games...
They're very difficult. And
they're extremely difficult.
Yes,
very,
absolutely.
Very, very difficult.
Absolutely.
So you he's sitting there now thinking...
But then maybe don't tweet. Don't tweet unless people can understand what you're saying.
I'm sure that's an argument, Gab. They've got Southampton at home next week. So they're going into every game already. This is crucial. And then after that, they've got Man City away, Man United away, and then Chelsea. So you're looking at those... if we get 1 point out of those... No, be fair. So...
I don't think any of us here are blaming him for sacking De Boer. All right, I'm not. But I am questioning how it's possible that year after year you put yourself in these situations. You've got these difficult games coming up, fine. You don't want to be stuck after eight games with just 3 points on the table, which is where you may well be, even if you beat Southampton. Right? I completely get that, and which is by no means a given. So nobody blames him. If you make a mistake, in fact, it's the grown-up thing to do. So, oh, look, I made a mistake. Let me go fix that, right? But Jesus, every year, it's the same freaking story. At some point, you need to take a step back and say, like, why does this happen?
Given that they have four very hard games coming up, does it make sense to pull the trigger now?
Or just let De Boer lose all the games?
No, I actually think if he's made a mistake, which he obviously has, and it just hasn't worked out, why think, oh, it's only been three or four games, I better wait until 10 or 50 because I'm going to get... Do it now. If you've made a mistake, do it now.
If you don't think it's going to improve, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I'm just questioning about a system where every time he seems incapable of reading individuals and knowing what they're going to do.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I don't think I'm going to surprise everybody, but for those who don't know, James Scowcroft is that rarest of gems in that he is one of those former Premier League and Championship footballers who had a long career and obviously got into games for free because he was playing in them. And of course, then he had mates in the game who got him free games. But no, throughout all this, he decided, guess what? I'm a football fan, too. I'm actually going to keep paying for my season ticket at Old Trafford, even though I live halfway across the country, and you still do, I believe. And so you went to the Britannia as a fan, as a traveling Manchester United supporter. Did you feel like going into it that it was kind of United's first serious test this season, given how bad? I mean, they didn't know ahead of time, but the opposition's been
I actually feel quite confident with Manchester United. You know, and it was very sort of divided. A lot of people think it was a good point. The typical Stoke away is never an easy game. I actually thought it was 2 points dropped. And had United been a little bit more clinical in front of goal and probably a little bit more clinical in the defensive areas, they would have quite easily won.
James, quite easily?
I was a little bit surprised that Mourinho went to a 4-3-3 with the 4-2-3-1 having seemingly worked so well in their previous matches. The balance of it seemed to be so good with Matic kind of sitting
against bad teams anyway.
I suppose so, yeah. I particularly like Mkhitaryan in a slightly more sort of central role, which obviously you can't really do with the 4-3-3.
Do you like this 4-3-3? Did you think it needs to be? I mean, which United do you like? Do you like this one, or do you like the one with Mkhitaryan, Mata, and you know whoever's over?
No, I like the United. My favourite player is Martial. I know some of the reasons why he doesn't start, but how he doesn't get into the starting lineup. Yeah. I would love Martial, Lukaku, and Rashford to be in a starting three. I've never seen in the last
Martial, Lukaku, and Rashford.
Martial,
Lukaku, and Rashford.
Yeah, as a front three.
Then tell me your midfield.
My midfield would be Pogba, Matic, and then I would have a number 10 rotate between Mata, Mkhitaryan.
And Lingard.
Lingard.
I love this. I love this because you know, you go, it's like you regress to being like 14-year-old with your Patini Snickers. Like you'd really do that? You drop Mata and Mkhitaryan for Lingard so that you could cram Martial and Rashford with
Martial's got to play. Martial's United's best player.
There's our headline for the podcast. Martial is United's best player. I love it. It's fine.
You bring
it's
me
cool.
on for an opinion. That's my opinion.
No, we all have our favorites. Stoke, we like what Sparky's doing. Switching to the back three, Peters and Mambir and Juve, two very different players on the two. I mean, Mambir and Juve was center forward, really, originally. Creating mismatches, is that a creativity that we don't normally ascribe to Mark Hughes, but maybe we should start doing that? The lineup he put out, I thought, was pretty sophisticated.
I think against the weaker sides, I just think they're hit or miss, Stoke. And I think at the weekend...
You're talking about Sparky's tactics here.
Yeah, I think they're hit or miss as well.
Oh, no, it's funny, because when he was younger, I imagine you as a little boy, Sparky.
Oh, he's one of my heroes. Favorite.
Exactly. Look, and now you criticize. That's, you know...
And he's gone from hero to zero with a lot of United people.
Speaking of that, I want to get your sense on this. This Mourinho-Hughes handshake stuff, for those who didn't know, earlier in the game. And by the way, because Mourinho wouldn't talk about it afterwards, in fact, he made this big to-do about how dare he even be, it's not very nice that you're even asking me the question, which I thought is, you know, vintage Mourinho, let's go and talk about nonsense to turn into Mr. Deflecto. But what we did see was... Hughes talking in his technical area with a fourth official. Mourinho wandering in the general area. Hughes said it was in his technical area. I can't tell from the TV pictures, frankly, if he was. And Hughes says something and kind of shoves Mourinho away. Then later, somebody briefs the media. I'm going to speculate and suggest it might have been United, but I honestly don't know, that Mourinho felt aggrieved because Hughes apparently... told the fourth official that Mourinho should be sent to the stands, and also some industrial language was used between the two. Personally, I would fine them both for just conduct unbecoming on the sidelines, but that's just me, and it probably wouldn't be fair. What would you do, James, in this situation? Is there an obligation to shake hands? Can we make people shake hands, the two coaches, after the game?
I really kind of struggled to be outraged about this sort of thing. I have no real kind of strong feelings on it, but if they kind of don't want to shake hands, I sort of don't really mind.
Are you outraged?
Yeah, I don't like people that don't shake hands.
So does that mean you don't like Mourinho?
No, I do like Mourinho. But I let him off on this. I just thought it was petty. I think you can embarrass people by shaking their hand at the end of the day and saying, you know, what Mark Hughes... Mark Hughes was niggly all afternoon on Saturday.
He was niggly as a player too.
Yeah. But that was allowed.
Well, the thing with Mourinho kind of made it a point to go and shake everybody, you know, right down to the tea lady's hand on the Stoke bench, but not Mark Hughes. So he obviously wanted to send a message. I don't know. We've seen this so many times, but I kind of feel like he made it into an issue. In some ways, if he had just kind of walked off without shaking hands and without making it a point to go and shake everybody on the Stoke bench's hand, it would have been even less obvious that he was snubbing Hughes and he felt annoyed. Yes. And I also feel that, you know what? If you're not going to shake somebody's hand, freaking man up afterwards. Somebody does his job by asking you the question, why did you not shake his hand given that you shake everybody's hands after games? Did something happen? And then answer the freaking question. Don't be like, well, it's not a nice thing. I mean, why? What's the big deal? So, yeah, I didn't feel like shaking his hand because I didn't like the way he behaved in the game. And we're going to complete an exercise that we started last week where we looked at Premier League clubs. We ranked them by net spend. And we got as far as Crystal Palace, funnily enough. They took Ruben Loftus-Cheek on loan. They signed Mamadou Sakho, did well for them last year. And Tim Fosu-Mensah. On the surface, hire Reid Vault. I suppose it's one of those things you do for your manager. And they let a whole bunch of players go, but didn't get any money back from them. Did this strengthen Palace? You happy with this, Scully?
I think they desperately needed a centre-forward in.
They didn't get one?
They didn't get one. And if Benteke gets injured, they could seriously have big problems. I know they let Fraser Campbell go, but hindsight, you probably would have kept him.
Liverpool. I'm trying to wrap my head around this because, again, their net spend, 33.8 million, slightly less than Crystal Palace, but they have committed some 60 million next season for Naby Keita, who's a player I love. Obviously, they turned down the Coutinho money. They brought in Mohamed Salah, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Andrew Robertson, and Dominic Solanke, who may or may not live up to the billing. Is this good or is it bad because ultimately they didn't address the fact that their centre halves are still named, you know, Joel, Dejan and Ragnar?
I really like the signing of Salah. He addresses an area of need. He will provide a lot of assists, I think. I personally have slightly more belief in Matip and Lovren than anyone else, but...
Okay, so you're okay with them not signing a fourth centre-half. Rattling on through this, Bournemouth, Scully, £20 million on Nathan Ake, £10 million on Asmir Begovic. I mean, Chelsea happy. On paper, you've added two guys who are solid and can do a job for you for a good amount of time. They hung on to all their stars. The other big signing, Jermaine Defoe, a lot of talk about his wages and the fact that it's a three-year deal at his age. To me, that deal makes no sense whatsoever.
That's two of us.
Do you like the Ake and Begovic signings?
I think Begovic is an excellent signing. I think they've got a very, very good... a lot of people underestimate how important a good goalkeeper is to have in your team, and I think they've got a very good goalkeeper that will be there for a while that will gain them points this season. I think that is one of the standout buys of the summer, actually.
So other than Defoe, you're on board with this?
Yeah.
Next up, Southampton. They kind of made their big statement this summer, I think, by hanging on to Virgil van Dijk. Obviously, Mauricio Pellegrino's come in. Not many people really overwhelmed. They spent quite a bit of money on Mario Lemina from Juventus, who I've seen a lot. Midfield playmaker type, can put the boot in. I think he really needs to go up several levels if he's going to contribute. And also Wesley Hoot, who... I don't know. He had a good season, very good season last year at Lazio. Did he have a £15.5 million worth of good season? I don't know. But you can kind of see the Hoot for Van Dijk partnership. You can sort of see maybe what they're trying to do. Well, what do you reckon?
Southampton is a tricky one because actually, I mean, the early problem that's kind of begun to rear its head for them this season is that they don't score enough goals, and they can maybe have done with sort of adding some creativity, because apart from Stephen Davis, they don't really have a kind of creative sort of number 10 type of player. Maybe done with adding one of those.
Newcastle, this is another one that's come under the spotlight, partly because nobody likes Mike Ashley, and as Rafa ages, everybody seems to love him more and more. But, you know, in the summer, they spent $20.9 million, which is dwarfed, actually, by the spending of Brighton and Huddersfield among newly promoted sides. Jacob Murphy, who's from your part of the world, so I'm assuming from Norwich. I'm assuming people are excited about him. I don't know.
A very good, sensible buy. What I would say is that they spent money last season in a championship, didn't they? And maybe people are overlooking that they spent possibly... They gambled last season on promotion, and maybe that's just had a curtailed effect on them so far this season.
Mikel Merino, I think, is an interesting one. and tells you a little bit. And I'd be curious to see what happens if he would ever play him with Xavi. Joselu, I'm not a big Joselu guy. I don't know. I can see why Rafa felt that maybe he would have liked to see a little more spending. West Ham, speaking of managers who've come under criticism, and you're going to go see them tonight, Gerbrandt. In the end, they spent a fair amount of money, 17.2 million net spend. They sold pretty well, I thought, as well, getting money back for Ashley Fletcher and Darren Randolph and Figuli, as well as Enner Valencia. But yeah, Pablo Zabaleta on a free, and it's one of those things everybody seems to love. Joe Hart on loan, 20 million on Arnautovic, 16 on Chicharito. Does that take you to the next level?
We did a sort of Time Sport online piece where all the writers sort of went through and picked their worst piece of business of the summer, and Arnautovic got quite a few shouts, which I think was fair enough, to be honest. It seems like an awful lot of money for someone who was always quite inconsistent at Stoke. They signed a lot of relatively old players, relatively experienced players, I think because they had such a kind of an absolute Horlicks of a transfer window last summer that they sort of went with more kind of proven quantities, but that's always a bit of a double-edged sword.
But it strikes me, though, and on paper anyway, they've added three guys who we all expect to be starters, right?
Yes.
Legitimately. Mm. Three and a half, Arnautovic.
I think Arnautovic is a good player.
Right, so if you've added four starters and your net spend is 17.2 million and you got rid of guys who weren't regulars, that's not bad, is it?
No, I think, only time will tell, won't it? But if you look at Joe Hart, Zabaleta, Chicharito as well, you got three good, experienced Premier League players that are, you know, good, solid professionals, good lads in the dressing room. So I think you can't really argue with those three.
I'm not hugely sold on any of West Ham's current crop of central midfielders. Like, I've seen Pedro Obiang.
You don't like Lanzini, no?
Sorry, Lanzini, I'm thinking more of as a sort of kind of attacking midfielder. I've seen Obiang and Mark Noble play really well, but I don't think they're consistent enough. I think they could have done with signing someone, you know, really dominant and consistent in that area of the pitch.
Next up, Leicester, Premier League champions 2 years ago. This is interesting because their net spend in the end, 13.5 million, really not that high. They roll the dice big time on Maguire, Ibarra in midfield, and Iheanacho. They got a ton of money back for Drinkwater, and they hung on to Riyad Mahrez.
And Damari Gray. Damari Gray seems
And Damari have... Gray, who was very much in demand. Did they miss a trick on not letting Mahrez go?
I think so. I think... he's adored in Leicester, and I think he's seen as a key part to what they've done and the future. I just think the player possibly has gone a little bit stale there. I think he does need to move on. I personally would have possibly sold him and kept Drinkwater, because I believe Drinkwater is quite a big voice in the dressing room there and a good pro. But I think if you actually look at the going into the window, Drinkwater was a target, Riyad Mahrez was a target, Damari Gray was a target at the end. So they've done well to keep most of them. They've lost Drinkwater. I think Harry Maguire is a very good signing. You know, if you look at Harry Maguire and compare him to Crystal Palace spending the money on Sacco, who would you rather have? Someone who's £10 million cheaper and going to be an England future? I think that's better business.
Or somebody who was a regular for France. Mm-hmm. But yeah, obviously. No,
he's not a regular for Liverpool, is he? He can't get in one of the worst defences in the league. So
just one. Can't argue with that point.
I really like the signing of Iheanacho. I mean, I don't like the fact that the Man City let him go. I mean, this is a player who is scoring at something like, I mean, yeah, he's playing a very good team in Man City, but you have to say his strike rate in the Premier League is absolutely exceptional. He's scoring at something like, you know, once every, I don't know, 105 minutes, something in that region. And for a player who's 20 years old, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a player, you know.
Well, they get £25 million for him. I mean, that's
what Chelsea played for Zappa Costa. You know, I mean, I thought it was cheap by the standards of this window.
It's gone to Tottenham. Now, the following teams all made a profit in the transfer window in net terms. For most of the summer, they looked like they were doing nothing. And then, other than signing Davinson Sanchez, I suppose, an extra body at the back. But then they picked up Serge Aurier, who I think is a calculated risk and probably a gamble worth taking. And Fernando Llorente, a player I really like. And again, they sold really well. 18 million for Kevin Vimmer. I mean, you kidding me? 51 million for Kyle Walker. They're just smarter at selling, and Is this enough to put them over the top, make them legit contenders?
Yeah, I thought it was a good transfer window, I have to say. We all are familiar with the fact that their issues revolve around the fact we have a very good first team, but not so much in reserve. And the Janssen experiment did not really pay off last season. I think Llorente is a definite upgrade on Janssen, and A, gives them a second option behind Harry Kane, but also a plan B.
Could play with Kane too.
Could also play with Kane. So kind of gives them a lot of options. I think Aurier, leaving aside the kind of
madness,
in purely playing terms, I think is a really good signing.
Let's go on to Stoke. Their net spend profit was around 5 million. You got veterans, what you'd expect. Dan Fletcher on a free, Vimmer, which I don't get, for 18 million. Hesse on loan, had a couple really good games already. Choupo-Moting on a free. Kurt Zouma on loan. Josh Tymon, who's another one of those guys who, you know, supposedly is a great future. I know you don't like Mark Hughes, and there's some childhood issues going on because he was your god when you were little.
I'm struggling to deal with Mark Hughes at the moment. I can't put him in a place.
Oh, this is good. They sold Arnautovic well. They sold Joselu, I think, pretty well given the circumstances. Are we going to say well done?
I like this transfer window. I think they overpaid for Vimmer, but I actually think he's quite a good signing. Zouma, I think, likewise. I actually quite like what Mark Hughes has done in terms of the attacking players that he signed, because I don't know if it will work, but basically I think Stoke, they went very stale, didn't they? I think after there was that period of where they were very exciting, and you know, they had Bojan and Shaqiri, and everyone was very excited about them. And then I think really after Bojan got injured, they went very, very stale. Last season, really disappointing. I think Mark Hughes in the summer could have gone for experienced Premier League attackers. I like the fact that he's bought players like Hesse and Choupo-Moting. He's taken a bit of a gamble. They're interesting buys. Whether they'll continue to play well throughout the season, we'll see.
Burnley, another team, made a profit, 10 million roundabout. Two huge sales, Michael Keane and Andre Gray. They got 43, 44 million for those two, which I think is pretty good. I don't really get £15 million on Chris Wood, although he's scored a couple goals already. Jack Cork's a player I really like. I thought was pretty good. And John Walters has already had an impact. So another thumbs up.
Naki Wells,
who comes from the Championship.
You know, I quite like. You don't know anything about the Championship either.
No, I don't.
So let me explain. Chris Wood has been possibly one of the best centre forward, if not the best centre forward in the Championship in the last.
I've seen him play for New Zealand.
Have you? Oh, right.
Big Lumpo.
Okay.
Which is fine. Depending.
Definitely the best centre forward in Oceania. I think we can.
Probably. Well, yeah, if you don't. Yeah. In the OFC.
Deserves his step up into the Premier League, and I think he's justified himself. If you look at him yesterday, he made his goal look a lot easier than what it was. Naki Wells is always a player that I've admired. A bit surprised Huddersfield have let him go. But I think under Sean Dyche, he's got reason to do well.
This is good. Yeah, thumbs up for Burnley?
Yeah, fantastic.
Perfect. Let's move on to Arsenal. They managed to make a profit of nearly 20 million, which is good news for the Kronk. Could have been a massive loss and a massive spend if they'd signed Lamar on the last day of the window. Could have all been very different. Instead, you're looking at Kolasinac on a free and 46 million on Lacazette and Alexis Sanchez sticking around.
I think with Arsenal, the headline in and out, and also who they kept, is kind of on the face of it, you know, really not a bad window at all. You kept Sanchez, which is probably, you know, the kind of single biggest issue facing them in the transfer window. Positive outcome.
You said goodbye to £50 million, but that's all right.
Well, they signed Lacazette, which I actually think it's sort of been slightly kind of underrated. I think it's maybe a more... that many more exciting signings in the Premier League this summer. Would that be fair to say?
Lacazette is an excellent signing.
Than Lacazette?
You could look at it another way. Since you love Lacazette so much, probably because he's French, you could have sold Sanchez and with that money paid for Lacazette and gotten Sanchez off your books. And all it would have cost you was a year's worth of Alexis Sanchez. Instead, you're going to lose Alexis Sanchez on a free. I mean, if you want to turn it around, look at it that way, right?
I think you should do as well. I just don't see the point in keeping Sanchez. Right. I don't.
So we. Get, I mean, the point. I mean, the point in keeping Sanchez is quite, even whether or not you agree with it, is quite clear that you know it's to have a good season this season. I mean, he's so.
Is he going to have a good season? I cannot see how he can have a good season in the situation he is.
But I mean, people said that about Luis Suarez, didn't they? When he didn't get
Robert
his
Lewandowski.
Move.
But I just think going back to Arsenal, it's kind of like it's the sort of it's the little things that just sort of don't make any sense, like the sort of what's going on with Joel Campbell, who's going off for his sixth loan spell or something.
Dude, I think, Joel Campbell is the least of Arsenal's
it's symptomatic. Like, I mean, I think apparently
joined up thinking, I think, is the word you're looking
correct.
For.
Correct, and then, you know, they supposedly offered 20 million for Callum Chambers. Wenger prefers Rob Holding, so why would you not get 20 million?
We do have a shortage of tall defenders, right? Yeah.
And they sold Gabriel.
And finally, Swansea, who are the transfer window winners in purely financial terms, with a positive net spend of £35.6 million, largely down to the fact that they tricked Everton into spending £45 million on Gylfi Sigurdsson, and I thought sold Llorente quite well, given the circumstances to Tottenham. They've added Sam Clucas, who's I think a very promising player. And they brought back Wilfried Bony, and they got Tammy Abraham on loan and Renato Sanchez on loan too. What do we think of this sort of strategy of saying, like, you know what, rather than going and spending all this money, let's go and get players from big clubs on loan and help them develop and help us along the way. Obviously, both players, by the way, who are from Paul Clement's old clubs.
That's great, but you're in the same position this time in 10 months' time, aren't you? There's no... You know, surely as an owner, are you developing players doing that? Surely you would like your own players, like Leicester have done with Damari Gray. Go and buy him from, who was an exciting young talent. Bring him on board, develop him. A, then you've got a first-team player and you've got somebody that you can sell on for 10, 15, 20 million pounds more.
I really didn't like effectively swapping, because they cost so much money, swapping Llorente for Wilfried Bony. I mean, I think that's a kind of huge...
Well, Llorente wanted to leave. That's the problem. That's the reality. Yeah, I'm not...
The quality of the replacement is not... I mean, I know he scored a lot of goals when he was at Swansea, but this is someone who's scored, I think, 8 goals in his last 2.5 Premier League seasons.
All right, enough of this nonsense. How about some quick hits? Chelsea win away to Leicester 2-1. Gerbrandt, they're 1 point off the top. Are you feeling a little more confident now, or will the Champions League and how they handle 2 games a week be the real test?
Well, I think obviously how they handle 2 games a week will be more testing, but I feel very confident about Chelsea. I thought it had actually a really good transfer window, and I think Conte is, you know, I think Conte is excellent. So I've got a lot of faith in them.
Would have been a better transfer window if they'd signed Llorente, of course, which they wanted to do. Tottenham romped to a 3-0 win at Everton, and now that August is over, Harry Kane is free to score again. Scoey, any good reason why we can't take Tottenham seriously as title challengers?
Yeah, they don't win the home games. Bit of a problem.
Boom, just like that.
Well, if you don't win your home games, you're not going to win the league, are you? They've got a problem.
They finished second last year.
Oh, last year? And what's
last year?
How many
home games have they had this year?
They have 2, and they've not won any.
One of them was against Chelsea.
And one was against Burnley.
Who beat Chelsea? Away. No, just saying.
I thought you were a Chelsea fan.
Speaking of Everton, that was pretty dire. Gerbrandt, we've spoken of poor squad construction before. How much of this is down to Ronald Koeman?
I think Koeman is, fundamentally, I think he's a good coach. But
he should not be allowed to buy and sell players?
Correct. I don't get a lot of their business this summer. I think actually they're actually really not reliant, but the kind of pace of Calvert-Lewin and also Davis, I think they're actually really, they're quite important players. And I don't see how they fit in when you've signed Rooney and Sigurdsson and Klaassen. Wow.
Arsenal stomp all over Bournemouth 3-0, and they do it without Alexis Sanchez starting. Scoey, does this mean anything, or does it just mean that the Cherries were once again awful?
The Cherries were horrific, awful.
They were the pits.
Yes, let's see the big test. They've got Chelsea at the weekend, Arsenal, haven't they? Let's see if it is a one-off or not.
What do you think?
I think it is. I think the opposition was poor. Arsenal are better than Bournemouth, but I think they'll get beat at the weekend. Back to square one.
Watford are one of only 4 undefeated teams in the Premier League after a 2-0 win at Southampton. Gearbrand, it seems that folks can't talk about Watford without mentioning how this is obviously a stepping stone for Marco Silva, and he deserves all the credit, and enjoy him while you can because he won't be there very long. Are you going to go down that route as well?
we've said very early stage of the season, I think Silva deserves some credit. I think as well you've got to give the club a bit of credit because they've bought the right players and also kind of subverted all the traditional wisdom about, you know,
bunch of foreign mercenaries on loan from Granada.
Well, exactly. Not having kind of a huge turnover of player and coaches. Watford make it work for them. The player that I really like is Doucouré. I think he's excellent.
Yeah, he's got a real presence about him, doesn't he? Jamal Lascelles scores a dramatic goal after making a dramatic goal line interception. And Newcastle go and win. And the Rafa Lucian is on. You feeling a little bit better about Rafa?
I didn't really feel any worse beforehand, really. I think it was an excellent win. I think Newcastle will be there or thereabouts. I think they'll just stay up. I think maybe Swansea have a few problems at the moment, especially defending corners zonally.
If they do stay up that way, then Ashley will be vindicated.
I think Mike Ashley gets a lot of people hide behind Mike Ashley at Newcastle. And it's always everything is Mike Ashley's fault. It can't always be his fault.
Gab, one for you. You wrote about homegrown players in Europe's top clubs today. Tell us more.
Yeah, so you know how City and Chelsea, but not just them, get a lot of stick because they spend all this money and they have all this super strong academy and they win all these trophies, but then these guys don't play in the youth team. I want to attack this idea that like a great academy produces players and makes them into stars, because I don't really think it's true. And what's difficult for the top clubs right now is, because of the Bosman rule, because of the polarization, the bigger clubs are at such a level that it's actually really, really hard, unless you're some kind of freaking superstar, to break into the starting 11. And as evidence of this, I look at the Champions League, which starts this week. There are 17 clubs from Europe's five big leagues in there. Out of those 17 clubs, I looked at how many players were homegrown. But I use my own definition of homegrown, which is players who joined the club before the age of 16, because otherwise it's very easy to go and cherry pick your Cesc Fabregas or your Paul Pogba. And I took out players who were over the age, who were age 30 or older, because, you know, obviously they broke into the first team at a different era. Out of 17 clubs, you know how many there are who meet those criteria, who, in other words, who joined that club before the age of 16 and are under the age of 30 and are regulars? There's 8. And that's counting people like Marcus Rashford, who, you know, may or may not be a regular. I counted him as a regular anyway.
He played 50 games last season, so you have to count that as a regular, don't you?
Yeah, he started...
Jesse Lingard, a regular?
No. Rashford started 16 of 38 games. But yes, I counted him as a regular, as a member of the best, of your hypothetical best 11. There's very, very few players who fit that criteria. And to me, this shows that when we think of like a great transfer, a great academy, we're talking, you know, a lot of times it's people who do a great job at scouting 16 and 17 year olds. And not because they're bad, but because taking a kid at 8 and having the luck to see his future ability and giving him the skills that he can go and play for one of the top sides in the world, which is what these teams are, is actually extremely, extremely difficult.
Hi there, and welcome to the Sweeper Recap. The Sweeper is the Times' fantasy football tips service, which will land in your email every Friday morning if you sign up at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball. I'm Charlie Scott, and I'm here with Paddy Bonbear.
Hi, everyone.
Bit of a tough one for fantasy football managers this weekend. If, like me, you may have sold Kevin De Bruyne and Harry Kane in order to make room for Sadio Mane. Spurs looked very impressive. Ben Davies was the top scorer of game week 4 so far, and he's the top scorer in the whole competition at the moment with 32 points. So the left back looks like he might be worth an investment.
Yep, and Harry Kane, as expected. August is over and the goals are flowing again. So their fixtures look very enticing for the next few weeks. So I would say if you have the means to find space in your squad for him and likewise for Christian Eriksen behind him, then that's definitely worth doing. That there are points coming in the next few weeks. Elsewhere, Kiko Femenia, the Watford fullback, was at it again. We told you before game week 3 that you should possibly take a punt on him, and 19 points in the past 2 weeks has turned out pretty nicely. So their fixtures look tricky, but at 4.5 he's great value to have in your squad. Elsewhere, there were a couple of unlikely players scoring big points. Pascal Gross at Brighton, Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting at Stoke. Danny Welbeck was a big scorer for Arsenal, and we'll have our usual weekend recap up on the Timesport website from Tuesday afternoon, and we'll be telling you whether those guys are worth getting in the coming weeks, or if it's all a mirage.
Just remember, you can sign up for the sweeper at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, and you'll get the email in your inbox on Friday morning, which will also include the winner of August competition, which was a very teasing question that Paddy put out last week, and the winner will get two tickets to Rio Ferdinand's Times Plus event in Manchester on Sunday, October the 1st.
That's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my guests, James Gerbrandt and James Scowcroft. Many thanks also to Matthew Syed, who joined us to talk about Dele Alli. Remember, you can subscribe to our newspaper. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. And you get the Sunday Times as well. Not as good, my humble opinion, but then I would say that because I don't work for them. This season, if you do that, you can access highlights of every single game in the Premier League, the Champions League, the Europa League, and, at least in the third round, the FA Cup as well. Next Monday, we'll be reacting to the weekend. Champions League has kicked off, and also Chelsea versus Arsenal, and maybe Crystal Palace will have a new manager by then.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.